Chevy Equinox with forward collision alert, automatic emergency braking, and available all-wheel drive. It's my ultimate mobile device. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule a test drive. Chevy Equinox. It's your choice. Own it.
Like a clown needs a shell, like a prisoner needs a cell, like a ding-dong needs a bell.
I hope you're dancing.
You need us.
In fact, you may know the words to this song. Sing! Go ahead and crank it, Griff.
You need me, like a picture needs a star.
It's Ginger,
like,
by the way. Okay, you can fade it out. Although we could play that thing all the way through, and that wouldn't be a bad use of our time. Hi, it's John Williams on WGN Radio. And that, of course, is, what's the name of that group, Bob Kessler? Do you know?
I have no idea. I am stumped.
It's the Honeybees from an episode of Gilligan's Island, circa 1968, okay, or something like that. And I was thinking, of Gilligan's Island when I read this one news story. I want to get to, it'll just take a second, then I'm going to talk to a friend of ours who is a scientist, Vicki Hansen, and she's going to talk to us about that planet they discovered. I want to make a little time to talk about the Dwayne Wade cousin and family situation. What a bizarre and tragic story we've heard too often. And then in this hour, we'll also listen to the Mincing Rascals mince about the very awful, terrible week that Hillary Clinton had. First this, a pair of mariners stranded on an uninhabited Pacific island for a week were rescued by a U.S. Navy air crew on Friday after writing SOS in the sand. Did you see the story? The boaters were marooned on an island in the Federated States of Micronesia. It was just a little uninhabited dot on the vast blue Pacific Sea. They had limited supplies, no emergency equipment. They had been there for a week. They carved SOS in the sand. And when a U.S. Navy P-8 aircraft flew overhead, they saw SOS in the sand and said, hey, that's probably the guys that were missing last week. They sent in a rescue boat, and they're okay. Now, as you recall, if you're a Gilligan's Island aficionado, in season two, in one episode, the professor had realized that a spaceship was going to be coming over the island. He was sort of charting the trajectory of the orbit, and he said that it's going to come over right over Gilligan's Island, and it'll be at night. So let's get a bunch of logs, soak them with kerosene, and then we'll light the logs, and as it comes overhead, they'll see SOS. Did you see this episode, Bob? Are you still with me on this?
I did not see that one, no.
It's the closest they ever came to getting rescued.
I do remember a space capsule one that floated to the island.
Yeah,
the astronauts got out. Was that the same one?
No, that was the cosmonauts. They were from Russia. I appreciate it if you'd pay attention to some of these things. So they
to bone up.
SOS. I should have told you what the major topic today was going to be. So they have SOS burning, and here comes the Americans in the spaceship overhead. And when they see SOS, they're going to rescue them. But then Gilligan accidentally knocks the logs on the last letter, and instead of SOS, it now spells SOL. Well, the name or nickname of the astronaut is Saul. And so as it goes over, he goes, hey, look at those nice people down there. They're spelling out my name in the lights. Thanks, everybody. And they sail right by without saving Gilligan and the gang.
Because SOL can stand for something else that astronauts, those guys are, they're SOL.
I know. That was before, I think that was the phrase. Okay. So SOL was the name. They waved Gilligan, Ginger, Marianne, the rest of them. They did not get rescued. Okay, I'm glad that we took the time to do that.
For several more seasons, they did not get rescued.
No.
They never did they?
No, they did. Well, I think they did. I think they did in a special. They did not in the run of the series, but eventually they were rescued in a highly rated television movie that featured the Harlem Globetrotters.
I remember that, yes. And the robot team, the New Invincibles. See, I know some stuff.
Thank you for paying attention. Researchers have confirmed the existence of a rocky planet. It's named Proxima B, orbiting Proxima Centauri, which is the closest star to our sun. Because of its location, researchers hope it will provide an opportunity for possible robotic exploration in coming centuries. The good news is that it is so close, the author of the study said. It is not only nice for having it in our neighborhood, but it is a dream come true for astronomers. If we think about follow-up observation, it's 4.2 light years away, 266,000 times the distance between Earth and Sun. But the exciting thing is it's just a little bit bigger than our Earth, and they say that the temperature there is maybe between 80 and 110 degrees, and it could have an atmosphere and water, and if so, it might have life, and maybe someday somebody or something could get there, or at least we could communicate with it. This is huge.
It's a Class M planet, as they would have called it on Star Trek. Any Earth-like planet was always a Class M.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Class M planet, yeah. And then they'd land, and there'd be Abraham Lincoln for some odd reason.
I know. Well, Vicki Hansen is on a line. She's a professor at the University of Minnesota Duluth. She's a science prof who's helped me understand things like this in the past, and we called her again today. Hi, Vicki. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Oh, very good. My pleasure to be here, John.
Would you like to talk about Gilligan's Island, or do you want to talk about this new planet?
You know, I remember Gilligan's Island, but I have to say that I learned something. I missed out on the SOL episode, so I think let's talk about the planet.
I'm better at Gilligan's Island, but let's do the planet instead. You know, another thing that I think I heard about this Proxima B planet is that a year on that planet is only 11 days. It's just whizzing around that sun of its, right?
That's right. That's right. So a 10-year-old would be 325 years old.
Exactly. Which would be great, because like
every you and I were.
Every week and a half you're having a cake and presents. Your uncle's here again. Hey, it's my birthday. I'm a year older.
Birthdays would get very boring, I have a feeling.
I also heard that the planet doesn't rotate around its sun. There's always a dark side and a sunny side. I didn't even know that was possible.
Yeah, there's actually debate about that. But that's like the moon relative to us, right?
Oh,
the
really?
Moon rotates around us, and we always see, that's why we talk about the far side of the moon, because the one face always faces us. It's called tidally locked. So if it is tidally locked, that might be bad news for life, because one side would be very hot and one side would be very cold. But they don't know if it's tidally locked or not.
I'm making a lot out of this. Are you? I mean, is this intriguing, fun, exciting, Vicki?
Yeah, I think that it's extremely exciting. It, you know, I mean, just to have an Earth-like, the potential, we don't know, but the potential of an Earth-like planet. And this is the closest star. This is the closest star to our solar system. So how cool to have something, literally cool, that is so close to us. And distances, of course, are far, and yet we're not going to find anything closer, because this is the closest star to our own solar system. And
the
possibility of a planet kind of like Earth or Venus is really exciting.
They didn't see it though, right, Vicki?
They didn't see it. We can't see it with a telescope. But now that we know it's there, and the data looks really robust, and what we do is there's a star, and the planet goes around, and by doing that, it pulls on that star, literally moves it, just like the moon pulls on us, okay, and what makes our tides. And we can see that very regularity of that pull. And so while we're not visually seeing it, the data is very, very robust that it's there. Now that we know it's there, we can start to look at it with other means, because now we know where to look, and we can use all kinds of different instruments to begin to look at it to start to understand more about the planet. So that's very exciting.
Yeah. I always knew somebody was paying closer attention than I was in class, but think about what we've done here. We are training telescopes or radioscopes or something on a planet 4.5 light years away, and we've noticed, good for us, we found that. Then B, we found that it wobbled a tiny bit, And just by that wobble, we're able to ascertain all the things you and I are talking about without even laying eyes on the planet.
Yeah, it's really, you know, physics are pretty amazing rules and really laws that once we can understand that, we can use physics and then we'll use chemistry to be able to study more about the planet. But those basics just, you know, are so incredibly powerful in terms of what they let us allow us to learn without seeing or hearing directly.
I just have a minute left here, Vicki. Is this the most Earth-like planet we're aware of outside our own solar system?
We don't actually know, but it is a terrestrial planet. It is a rocky planet. It is a planet that sits within the potential of what we call the Goldilocks zone. That means not too hot, not too cold. It's very close to its star, but that star is very much cooler than ours. So when we think about first order things of the Earth, it probably is the most Earth-like, and it is certainly, absolutely the closest.
Hmm. Okay, Vicki.
A long shot.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, let you and I continue to follow the stories and the news about this. And, you know, if somebody waves on the other end, I'm going to call you up and ask you what that meant, okay?
Sounds good. You watch for it and see if you can't see something on that planet.
That's Vicki Hansen, University of Minnesota at Duluth, a scientist and friend of this show. Thanks again, Vicki. All right, we'll pause for just a minute here. I want to talk a little bit about this Dwayne Wade story, and we'll get to that in a minute on WGN. Bob's been doing the story today. You've been hearing it elsewhere as well. This is the way the Chicago Tribune is writing about it. Chicago basketball star Dwayne Wade's cousin was shot dead while she was pushing her baby in a stroller yesterday afternoon near an elementary school. Parkway Gardens neighborhood, Nikia Aldridge, 32, and a man were walking on South Calumet about 3:30 in the afternoon. Two men approached. Someone began firing at the man, but Aldridge was hit in the head and the arm, taken to Stroger Hospital, where she died. The baby was not hurt. Nikia Aldridge, 32, cousin of Chicago Bulls star Dwayne Wade, was shot and killed, pushing her baby on a stroller and on the south side. Now, the daughter of Wade's mother's sister. Wade issued this statement on Twitter, quote, "My cousin was killed today in Chicago. Another act of senseless gun violence. Four kids lost their mom for no reason. Unreal. Hashtag enough is enough," the post read. The day before that shooting took place, Dwayne Wade actually appeared on a panel discussion that was recorded for ESPN. On the panel were Isaiah Thomas, Kenny Williams, Michael Wilbon, and others, and they were talking about violence in the cities and the role that athletes like Dwayne Wade have. What are we going to do about this? I can't play all of it for you, but it's pretty good. It's on the Chicago Tribune site. You'll find it elsewhere. Here's just a little of the question and answer with Dwayne Wade.
First, I'd like to get into what your experience was like here growing up. How did you navigate the streets? Because it was violence then, but how were you able to navigate the streets of Chicago?
Well, I mean, my experience when I was there, it was a lot of us killing us. It was a lot of gang-related issues when I was growing up. It was a lot of black and brown people killing each other. And it was a lot of, you know, it was about territory. You know, you couldn't go in certain areas. You couldn't wear certain colors. So, you know, my family, who was, you know, very involved in everything that was going on in the community, kind of tried to shield me away from it, wouldn't allow me to go certain places, wouldn't allow me to do certain things. As most guys in the community, when they play sports, you know, some people guard them and allow them to, you know, to go and do that and not get involved in the drugs. But it was all gangs and drug related when I was growing up there.
How did you view the police when you were growing up here in Chicago?
Well, when I was growing up, I was scared of them. it was very, you know, unpredictable of, you know, what they may do. I mean, me growing up in Chicago, you know, my story about my mother and, you know, my family has been very well documented. And police knocked down our doors many times. And, you know, you didn't know what to expect from them. You know, sometimes they would be nice to you. Sometimes they would plant something on you. So a lot of times, you know, I would run if I heard any loud knock, if I heard the police. You know, me and my sister would jet out the back. So, you know, it wasn't really, you know, police friendly And it's kind of like, you know, deja vu. It's kind of, you know, you kind of feel the world going back to that place now where our kids, you know, are afraid.
So what have you told your own?
That's Dwayne Wade, and that panel discussion was recorded the day before his cousin got shot and killed on the south side of Chicago. And then he talked about what he talks to his sons about. How do you deal with the police? And he also made this point at the end of that conversation. He said, can I just say one more thing? He said that there has been a time in Chicago and maybe in this country where black Americans felt like they did not have sufficient education or economic opportunity, even healthy food, he cited. And he said, so it was sort of like us against the world and us against each other. He said, we need to forget that mentality of everybody fighting for themselves. We need to think globally. We need to think like a community. We need to come together. He said some really smart, you know, balanced things. And how ironic and what a shame that the next day his cousin is shot. The news is next. Afterwards, the Mincing Rascals talk about the presidential campaign here on WGN. Help me out, Bob. Is this the first time you and I have talked on this show since you played the harmonica for us at our Teddy Roosevelt show?
It is the first time. Yes.
Thank you, sir. You were a hit.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Attention people who are booking parties and need a harmonica player. Contact Bob Kessler at WGN.
There you go.
He's really good. He's really good. You look great. And everybody appreciated having your little additional information and entertainment for us. So now we go on to Thomas Jefferson. That'll be Saturday, the 5th of November. I bragged on Facebook the tickets are almost sold out. And then somebody said, they're not really almost sold out, John. I thought, well, that's me pushing it. That's marketing. We have about 700 seats available, and we've sold close to 500, which in my world is almost sold out.
Yeah.
Go to WGNradio.com/events, and the Saturday before the election, Thomas Jefferson will talk wise to us. So I'm really looking forward to that. WGNradio.com/events for more information. Because this has just been such an upsetting year that I think it will be good to have his wisdom and humor on stage. I mean, look at all of the good that the Clinton Foundation is trying to do and the controversy that it is generating because of the way Hillary and Bill Clinton have been handling it. Literally, I think if it wasn't named the Clinton Foundation, we wouldn't have this problem. So I brought this up to the Mincing Rascals. Krista McQuarrie, who is an editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune, Eric Zorn, the columnist, and WGN Radio's own Steve Bertrand. Each week we record on Friday the podcast The Mincing Rascals. I want you to subscribe to that wherever you subscribe to podcasts or listen to it on WGNplus.com. But here is Kristen lighting up on Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation.
If she is elected president, yes, I do not think the first husband should be running a charity that is raising millions of dollars from foreign governments. I mean, the idea that they should have been praised because, well, you know what, we're going to dial it down. We're not going to accept, you know, these certain donations if she's elected, but we're going to let our Canadian arm continue to raise money. That's just a recipe for disaster. I mean, do you really think that Saudi Arabia donated millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation because they are so supportive of the Clinton Foundation's efforts to make HIV drugs cheaper for HIV illness victims? Why do you think these governments are writing huge checks? And by the way, how much do you think $25 million in U.S. money is to many of these other governments?
Well,
they want access.
They're
getting it.
While I agree with what Kristen has said so far, I would add the same question could be asked about why does anybody donate to these political campaigns in such huge amounts of money? Do you think
charities or political campaigns? You said
political
that.
Campaigns. I mean, why do people donate to political campaigns? The situation of money buying access in politics is nothing new. This particular combination, I agree, the Clintons should have, as soon as she was appointed Secretary of State or nominated for Secretary of State, they should have said shut it down. They should have merged it with the Gates Foundation or some other foundation, gotten out of it. They do good work, but it's everything's been tainted by this association. Kristen's absolutely right. There's no way to avoid these conflicts of interest and you know who's giving money and why.
Well, the appearance of a conflict.
You're right. The appearance of conflict. It was as tone-deaf and obtuse a decision as was Hillary Clinton's decision.
Bill Clinton walking across the tarmac to get on the attorney general's plane.
I mean, let's tell those kids who finally have clean water that they shouldn't have it it doesn't look good.
That is a far exaggeration from what we're saying.
I know, but I love those.
No, but I mean, well, that is what happens. If you shut the Clinton Foundation down, and I don't think we're saying that,
I'm just so happy to hear you say, you know, that it does great work, because no one's saying that. And
that
objectively, they do wonderful things around the world.
They also spend a lot of money on their employees and on airfare. And I'm going to trust Charity Watch if they say that they have a good ratio of.
They give them an A rating.
Okay,
give the American Cancer Society a C and Easter Seals a B minus.
Okay, well, I trust the charity rating organization.
No, really. I mean, it's kind of a different way that they do their charitable work. Instead of passing money on to charities, they just do the work themselves. So their numbers. I mean, somebody called my show the other day and said, "Do you realize that the amount of money that the Clintons give through the foundation gives to charity, is 2.9%. And I said, well, that sounds suspicious. I've got to look into it. So about 3 or 6%, Carly Fiorina on the campaign trail was saying only 6% of the money goes to charity. And that's a true statement if you look at just the money they donate to other charities. But in terms of what percentage of the money actually goes to programs and services that they provide, it's 88 or 89%. The average for charities is 75. So we can say whatever we want about the Clintons, but I don't think it's fair to say that that's a bad charity. And what a shame it would be if that thing is shut down.
And I agree. I do agree with you, Kristen and Eric, that, you know, something will have to be done with it. But I think, Eric, you have another great point. Why is it okay for a corporation to give untold millions of dollars to a campaign? Isn't that about access?
It's all public. It's public record. Charities do not have to list who their donors are.
But they do.
The Clinton Foundation did.
But it's not a requirement. I mean, they're essentially a private entity. We would have no idea who was giving to the Clinton Foundation if there hadn't been some pressure from the public because she's running. It's a great charity. They should be allowed to raise money. Do it when you leave office. You know, there is no reason that while she is president of the United States, they should have this $2 billion, by the way, that's how much this charity has raised, $2 billion operation on the side where there is a potential for a conflict or overlap.
Explain that to me. What happens with the conflict of interest? What happens then, Kristen?
There have already been stories. AP, not a partisan organization, reported earlier this week that they FOIA'd Hillary Clinton's schedule, and many of the people that she met with are people who donated to the Clinton Foundation. So
yeah, I know that.
Half of the people who weren't in government, so half of the private people who met with her, had private meetings, were also donors. I mean, that's a damning number.
82 out of like 154, yeah. Something.
But
like that.
Out of thousands of meetings.
But then where's the corruption? Is it that they donate? Tell me then that the Clintons then let somebody out of jail who shouldn't be out of jail, or they got gold bars in a trunk. I mean, the smoke is what you guys are describing. She said there's no fire. So tell me where the actual breach of conduct was then.
There is some evidence that people who donated to the Clinton Foundation later asked her for things and got them.
I'm talking
about like sports tickets. All right. I'm not saying that, you know, somebody got a really juicy contract in the Middle East. But there are cases where people donated to the Clinton Foundation and then there's an email trail linking them to asking for help
official?
From this or that.
It's got to be an official act. It's got to be, if you're talking about like they gave them sports tickets, that's nothing. That's like that's not a political issue. That's not a crime. If Hillary Clinton did in any way change U.S. foreign policy, did something, got somebody out of jail, as John said, changed something, made some sort of substantive change, that's a crime, a disqualifying event. That's horrible.
There were people who got meetings with her.
Meetings?
Who wanted,
yeah.
No, well, I'm just meetings. Saying that that's all I'm suggesting is
right,
that
but
this.
Don't you, do you agree, though, Kristen, that getting a meeting with someone isn't the equivalent of getting a policy from someone?
Yes, I do. But I don't know that we've dug enough to be able to connect State Department business and what was going on.
Well, let me give you guys one example. So the U.S. did approve a sale of uranium or some sort of nuclear substance to Russia. And that happened while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. State was one of the nine agencies or so that had to sign off on this sale to some uranium company or from a company to Russia. There was this exchange, right?
Right.
She was her office was involved, and money was coming in from either the president of that company or that country to the Clinton Foundation. So you could describe that as a coincidence. She said it didn't have any bearing on her decision.
Didn't the other eight agencies give it a thumbs up, too?
Yeah, I mean, okay, the sale happened.
Right, okay. So, but it wasn't as if State was an outlier in that and taking the donors.
No, donor also gave, I believe, $50 million.
Let me be the Clinton Pollyanna.
A lot of money.
You know, I fairly criticize sometimes for being too easy on Hillary Clinton, but let's look at it the other way. Okay, so they are leveraging their fame and notoriety to raise billions of dollars to help poor people around the world. Maybe that's something we should applaud, as long as we're not seeing that it's having an influence
right.
on politics.
They're not putting it in their pocket.
So do it when they. That's what every president does when they leave. They start a foundation. They raise money. That's what Bill Clinton did. But his wife is now possibly going to be the leader of the free world.
Well,
you dial it back.
I think you do more than that, and you do it when she becomes Secretary of State. I mean, this
right.
is where,
she
this is where
done
I'm
this
in total agreement.
Ago.
I think I'm in, yeah. in total agreement with Kristen, which is like when
this never happens.
I know.
Let Eric have the floor, please.
When she became Secretary of State, they needed to dissociate the Clinton name from this foundation and probably the Clinton family from it, because it is this potential for conflict of interest. The appearance of impropriety is strong. And, you know, I mean, I think that you could have folded this in, like I said, to the Gates Foundation, to some of these other things that do international global health stuff without harming children who have clean water. I just think of that it's unseemly to have your Secretary of State with her name on a charity that's going around shaking the cup in front of foreign
She did say today that they do that. I mean, she indicated, I should say, in an interview that they plan to transfer some of these to other organizations.
And they said that when she
just
becomes
their Canadian operation.
When she becomes president, they're gonna
try not to giggle when you say that. All right, Kristen,
all get right, out I'll
of there. This is one of these regrettable decisions, as I said, that Hillary Clinton made along with her private email server.
Eric,
these
does
things,
Chelsea have to step down too?
I just think the Clintons have to get their name off it. I think Chelsea Clinton can work for a charity called the Chelsea Foundation or something like that. But
most people who acquire wealth when they come into public office, they put that in a trust. They do something to totally dissociate themselves from the money. And the forms that charities have to file to list, you know, how much they're spending and where the money's going are not detailed at all. So I know they do great work, but they also have a bunch of the Clinton buddies on their payroll. And we don't really know how they spend their money, because it's not required under law to be that detailed in your expense accounting like it is for campaigns. You spend $25 on gas for your campaign. You have to report that. It's not the same for charities.
All right, last topic. And Kristen, you'll go first. It was originally Comiskey. Then it became known affectionately as the cell. Now, because Chico bail bonds isn't available, Southsiders will be playing at Guaranteed Rate Field. Your thoughts?
I mean, could we have done worse? I'm not sure. Maybe like Vagisil Stadium.
Is there no shame? Is there no shame in naming ballparks anymore? Or you know, end of the year college football bowl games. If anybody has the money, I guess you get to get the naming.
Who's
rights,
this
right?
on? Is this on the Sox or the state?
It would have
That's
been
a good question.
Actually, the Illinois Sports Facility
right.
Planning Board would have done the deal, because they have the rights. They negotiated the deal with US Cellular, but they don't really do anything without White Sox approval. I mean, I can't criticize the money part, because it is a taxpayer subsidized stadium. So anything they can do to increase revenue, they should be doing. But it's just, this is why when it changed from Comiskey to U.S. Cellular Field, I have always just called it Sox Park. I'm going to Sox Park. You should just call it that going forward and ignore this, you know, Peter Francis Tracy bankruptcy field.
He'll call you. He calls. He will call you.
He will call you.
Like Kristen, I've also for years said I'm not going to Sox Park.
I say Comiskey.
Another
I
year that Comiskey. I'm not going to Sox Park.
Well,
but, you know, it was, but, you know, I have to say, my press fedora is off to Guaranteed Rate. It's a brilliant move on their part, and it seems like they've already gotten. What do they think? They paid like $13 million, or I mean, nobody really knows, but they paid, you know, in the 10, $10 to $20 million range for this. They've almost gotten that much worth of advertising already. It's brilliant. The name is going to be all over the place.
The larger question is why we in the media really give this free advertising to companies who buy a stadium. Now, you know, and it's just, especially for me with the football bowls, you know, the Ameritrade Rose Bowl. Why do we report it that way? It's the Rose Bowl. Why doesn't someone say the Rose Bowl? I can understand if you're under contract to broadcast it. You've got to give it.
The TV network.
Sure, I get that. But if you're not, if we're sitting in Chicago or Wichita or wherever and doing a news story on it, why do we play that game?
Why is it necessary for us to say the Sox, when the Sox are playing at home tonight, the Sox are playing over at Sox Park, why don't the announcers on radio
and
TV?
People say, well, Wrigley Field, what about Wrigley Field? I mean, that was owned by a guy named Wrigley. I think that's
it was part of the Wrigley Gum Company, right?
But it was also owned by a guy named Wrigley. I mean, I don't know. Was it done there to publicize?
I never ever think of Wrigley Gum when I hear Wrigley Field. So it doesn't really work as an advertisement. I don't think I'm going to be able to dissociate guaranteed rate from the mortgage company whenever I hear that.
Do you think of United Airlines when you say United Center?
I don't, and that's interesting. Either. And the reason is because United is just is a word.
Could be United States.
But if you hear like the Allstate Arena, I always think of the insurance company when I hear Allstate Arena.
The Sox are the second baseball team in Chicago, and they're on the poor side of town. And I think they're always trying to...
Kristen has collapsed in her chair.
Let me just finish this prejudiced thought of mine. And
the poor side of town. I'm never going to forget that one. Okay.
And if they're trying to build the brand or franchise or get more people to go to the ballpark, I think they should do something that images them other than this.
Less is more.
Yeah, I think they're being penny wise and pound foolish here.
I disagree. I think they're going to no one's going to care. After a few years, no one's going to care. And
after
they're
going
to use that money and they're going to hire a shortstop that's going to put them in a division.
What's the name going to evolve since we've talked about or pivot.
pivot.
What's the name going to pivot to? Because it became the Cell. You know, it wasn't U.S. Cellular Field. The grave.
There
I think
go.
Kristen's right. Let's go to Sox Park. Well, that's one way to call it. So if you want to hear the full podcast, and we got after Trump with this much energy, and for that matter, the Duckworth-Kirk race, just subscribe to the Mincing Rascals wherever you subscribe to podcasts or listen to it at WGNplus.com. That's Eric Zorn, Steve Bertrand, Kristen McQuarrie. I'm John Williams. Back in a minute on WGN. Oh, I get to talk now? Okay, good. So I thought we had one more spot. I know we got to take a quick break here, and then we'll get you to the news. And then afterwards, we'll do something that I don't think I've ever done on this show. As much of a fan as I am of our presidential conversations, I've never talked to the man behind the presidents before. We will today for a couple of reasons. One is that Teddy Roosevelt, as you probably know, is a big proponent of our national park system. Maybe he was the father of it. I don't know if he has that title, but he sure did create a lot of national park space. Clay Jenkinson plays Teddy Roosevelt on stage. We had such a great conversation with him. I wanted him to talk to us just a little bit about that and then preview the Thomas Jefferson Show, which we are going to do on stage at the College of DuPage in November. Griff, you will, I guess, introduce us on stage again in November, as you did this past week, a couple weeks ago. What stands out in your mind when you see Jefferson or Roosevelt on stage? Tell people who haven't seen the show before what you hear or see.
My favorite thing in the I do prefer the Teddy Roosevelt shows. He's got more bombast than Jefferson does. Although the ideas are certainly interesting. It's more ideas based, right? Would you say with Thomas Jefferson and more story based with Roosevelt? I honestly do prefer those. I love when he talks about going out to the West to be a cowboy.
Yeah.
And that time in his life. And you think this is a man who was president. And then he unabashedly describes the time that he was out there, branding cows and whatever else as the time of his life. That was the most important to him. And to think about how he did so much more, it's just a surprise that there's a lot of things you just aren't expecting. And I think that's my favorite thing about it.
Yeah, he's a lovable Donald Trump. I mean, he's a brilliant, lovable Donald Trump, which maybe doesn't make him a Donald Trump, but he had this outsized personality and ego. He owned every room he was in, and he was an adventurer. I mean, San Juan Hill and Africa and South America and the Dakotas. And, You will be able to hear part of that conversation, in fact, Monday, Labor Day, here on WGM. But the Jefferson Show, Griffin's Right, is more ideas-based. It's more the feeling of America. And so that's why we scheduled him closer to the election. We'll talk with that man after the news. That's next on WGN. Okay, thank you, Bob Kessler, for that. So in this hour, as we normally do on a Saturday afternoon on WGN here on the John Williams Show, we'll take a little time, say around 2:40, to do our Vibe Score segment. We'll pop in on all things news and pop culture. Griff will walk us through it, and we'll score things. You can always do that with our app called Vibe Score. Vibe Score is one word, V-I-B-E-S-C-O-R-E. It's free. Get that on your iPhone, and then you can play along. We'll get to that. And the boys of the beat will talk a little sports with us in the next half hour as well. On a phone line now, though, is someone I've talked to many times, but never quite like this. This is Clay Jenkinson, historian, author, and raconteur. Hi, Clay. How are you?
How are you, John? It's great to talk with you.
Not sure I even recognize your voice in this capacity. You play Thomas Jefferson and Teddy Roosevelt for us on stage.
It's so hard for me to talk to you as an actual human being. It's so much easier to be a historical figure.
Well, it's funny because for years, I mean, so Clay Jenkinson is, as I said, author. He's a historian. He's an adjunct professor. He's a tour guide leader. He's a video star. He has all of these hats, and they center around his knowledge and ability to recreate these presidential characters that we then turn into stage shows, live, spontaneous conversations on stage. They sell out every single time, and we learn something new every single time. And for 10 years, you and I had been doing these things, and people would ask me, what's Clay Jenkinson like? And I wouldn't have a very good answer because almost all of my conversation with you had been in character. I didn't talk to you outside of the guise of Roosevelt or Jefferson.
Yeah, I think I'm basically like you, John. That's one reason why we're good friends. I'm a little bit left of center, but not much. I try to be nonpartisan and independent. I can't go along with a lot that the Democrats have been doing, and I certainly can't go along with what the right wing of the Republican Party has done to that once venerable party. And I try to see things on the merits and to look at the evidence. And so I think there's a natural affinity between our ways of seeing life. I think you're maybe a little funnier than I am.
Well, I'm a lot funnier than Thomas Jefferson was, that's for sure.
That's true, yes.
But that's the challenge for you. I mean, whatever our political leanings or thoughts are, you have to then put those on the shelf. I don't. You have to give us Jefferson and some of the things coming out of Jefferson's mouth. I don't think any of us like, least of all you.
Well, what comes out of Jefferson's mouth is a set of race views and attitudes towards women and slavery and American Indians and so on that we have, as a country, thank goodness, graduated out of. We're much more enlightened people today in those regards than we were in the time of Jefferson. But on the other hand, Jefferson has some insights about the nature of civilization and culture that are eternal and that are absolutely essential for a great republic like ours to keep in mind. And so he's a bit of a mixed bag. But with Theodore Roosevelt, you know, I just say what he would say, and it's often crazy stuff. It's a little bit like Donald Trump if he read books. But Roosevelt was one of the best educated men in American history. He was—he has a bombastic style, and he was a super patriot and at times a warmonger. But he also was an intellectually extraordinary human being and one of the most thoughtful presidents in American history. So it's a little bit easier to be Roosevelt because you just start talking and never stop. With Jefferson, there's all that enlightenment, you know, pausing and thinking on your feet and recognizing the legitimacy of the other point of view.
Yeah. Well, I think Jefferson needs me more on stage than Roosevelt does, that's for sure. And I asked you to come on today because we're doing a Jefferson show in November, and I wanted to make people aware of that. But also, let's just talk about, and so before we wrap up this conversation with that reminder, let's talk a little bit more about Roosevelt. The show we did really is going to be broadcast in part on this radio station on Labor Day in the early afternoon. But isn't this also, Clay, like the 100th anniversary of the National Park System or something like that?
Yes, it was this week. The 25th of August is the 100th year of the National Park System, something called the Organic Act. It was passed during the Wilson administration in 1916. It wasn't the first national park. That was Yellowstone in 1872. but it was the time when we professionalized the national park system. And here's where Roosevelt comes in, John, and this is why I love Roosevelt. We were in danger of creating what might be called the Aspen effect, that only rich and powerful people would go to the national parks and they would be almost private pleasure gardens for the most privileged Americans. And Glacier National Park has a little bit of that even to this day. But Roosevelt said, no, the national parks are for everyone. No matter who you are, what your economic background, or anything else about you, you have a right to go into a national park and squat around a fire and eat beans and bacon and drink camp coffee and listen to the coyotes at night and look at the stars. And he said that's the ultimate democratic experience. It goes back to Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone. Yeah. It's what made this country great, and we're not going to turn our national parks into rich man's pleasure palaces.
There is, I don't remember where I read this, but my understanding is that the way you're describing, say, access to these great national natural resources is the same attitude we had about museums. It was thought that really not everybody should be able to go look at art or sculptures in museums. That should just be for the elite. What a terrible idea that is.
Well, the class structure broke down in this country beginning with the presidency of Andrew Jackson. But, you know, if you go to Aspen even today or Vail, you have the feeling that maybe you're not fully welcome there. You know, yeah, that maybe you belong on the edge of town in a motel, but that the rich control these places. That's what Roosevelt wanted to avoid. And so he did that. The Organic Act has a paradox in it, though, John. It says that we must maintain these national parks unimpaired for future use, and yet we must make them accessible to the public. And so, as you know, we're loving the national parks to death. Yosemite is choked with traffic, Yellowstone, Great Smoky Mountains. That we have to, in the 21st century, in the second century of the national park system, address some really significant issues. I've listed about 10 in my lectures over the past couple of months that must be addressed if we want to maintain what Ken Burns and Wallace Stegner and others have called America's best idea, the national parks.
What are some of the highlights of that? I don't know. I don't have time for all 10.
Well,
but give me some.
I know. Just give you a couple. There's some delayed maintenance that certainly needs to be done. We need to, at, say, Yellowstone. Yellowstone is a square, but it doesn't cover what might be called the Yellowstone ecosystem. And so when wolves or buffalo or grizzly bears go out of the perimeters of the park, they don't know they're leaving the park. They're in their natural habitat. But then they get in people's yards and have to be shot. So we have to find a way to increase the traffic corridors for wildlife through the national forests and the national parks so that we don't have to have always these euthanizing moments when a buffalo happens to wander into town. So there's one. Indians were victims of the national park system. Many of the national parks were takings from Native American land, and so at least we need to be more cautious about telling the Native American story within the parks, and maybe there's some modest repatriation that can be done, and so on and so forth. There's I have a long list. I think any person looking at this will find out these answers online somewhere, but we need another expansive moment like Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, where we tune up and expand the national park system. It's the envy of the world, John. We started it in 1872. We started a worldwide movement, and now there are more than 1,100 national parks worldwide, and they were all inspired by us, the United States.
Did Roosevelt save the bison, or didn't he do something to sort of keep a pure specimen, if you will, of bison, and that's what we have on the fields today, our prairies today?
This is my favorite current subject. I just lectured about it out in Medora in Theodore Roosevelt National Park yesterday for the centennial. So Roosevelt killed a buffalo in 1883, but he realized they were going to go extinct. So he formed the Boone and Crockett Club, which was a kind of a pheasants forever, ducks unlimited sort of club. But then he worked with a man named William Hornaday of the Smithsonian, and they together essentially saved the American bison. And Hornaday came out to Montana and had a conversion experience when he saw all the dead carcasses lying all over the place. And he realized that this great quadruped, the greatest of American creatures, was going to go extinct if there were not an intervention. And he and Roosevelt and a few others saved the bison. And a lot of it was done at the Bronx Zoo, which was called the New York Zoological Society. And after that, the main strains that are now in Wind Cave and Yellowstone and Theodore Roosevelt National Park and so on came from that DNA that was preserved in a pure fashion by Hornaday and Roosevelt at the Bronx Zoo. So Roosevelt and Hornaday are the men who saved the bison.
Is there who is a modern person or president who had their hands in as many things as Roosevelt? You know, you got San Juan Hill and the Panama Canal and the bison, to say nothing of the political endeavors. Do we have a modern equivalent of Roosevelt?
No. You know, in some ways, Lyndon Johnson had as expansive a view of government possibilities as Roosevelt, but you can't imagine Lyndon Johnson camping in Yosemite or Barack Obama or Bill Clinton. You know, imagine Bill Clinton camping out in Glacier National Park. That strain is gone. Roosevelt was an authentic war hero. He was an authentic cowboy and rancher and big game hunter, and he loved to go out and eat camp coffee and sit out and listen to coyotes. We haven't had a president who wanted to do that since Jimmy Carter. Remember, he had that encounter with that mad rabbit or something. I mean, Carter had the impulse. He just didn't have the stones
to take down the rabbit.
He couldn't do the rabbit.
Real quick, I don't know what your favorite Roosevelt story is when you're lecturing or talking to us on stage. There are so many good ones, but the one that I find the most difficult to believe is the one where he confronts the guys that stole his boat and tracks them down and reads them Anna Karenina or whatever it was.
Yeah, so guys, very quickly, two guys stole his boat. He wanted his boat back. It was a blizzard, so he built a makeshift boat and tracked them down. He made a citizen's arrest, and then he had to march them overland a distance of 45 miles through blizzards and gumbo mud and cactus to Dickinson, North Dakota, where he turned them into the sheriff for a $50 reward. The sheriff said, "Why didn't you just hang them?" But Roosevelt wasn't going to do that. He was a law and order man. So he had to stay awake, John, for like 4 days. And to stay awake, he read out loud the just-published English translation of Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. He read it aloud to the boat thieves. President.
I know. And did he do – you know, here's the problem with the Roosevelt stories. It's easy to lose the timeline. He did that before he was president, right?
He was 1886. And so when he turned them in, he met this doctor on the streets of Dickinson, North Dakota. The doctor patched up his feet, and then he wrote a letter to his brother back in Vermont and said, "I've met the most extraordinary man that I've ever met in the whole course of my life." He said he was all teeth and eyes, but he said, "I think this man's going to go far. This is someone who could later be a great leader in this country." And so as early as 1886, people were predicting that Roosevelt might become the president.
So that's the Roosevelt story in part, and you'll hear our guest here.
Much longer versions, of course.
As Roosevelt on Labor Day. And then,
but John, when's the last time you were in a national park? When's the last time you sat and drank camp coffee?
Will you dislike me if I say I don't think I've ever done that? Was I in the Shawnee National Forest?
We've got to get you out to Yosemite and to Yellowstone and Glacier and Rainier and Big Bend and Arches and Canyonlands and the Grand Canyon, John.
We're going to do our Jefferson show as we wrap up this little conversation, Clay, at the College of DuPage again, which has kind of been our home now for a while. Yeah, and as Griffin said earlier, that'll be more about ideas, but I think those ideas will be needed the first week of November. The most important thing Jefferson will try and impress upon us, would you say, when he comes in November, what will that be?
Well, that the country will always survive even bad leaders, and that the people are wiser than they might think, that they have good sense, and that the Founding Fathers built in self-correcting mechanisms into our Constitution, so we will never veer very far from good sense.
Well, I hope so. WGNradio.com/events, WGNradio.com/events. When Ken Burns did his multi-part biography of Thomas Jefferson, the lead interview was this man, Clay Jenkinson, on stage with me at the College of DuPage. And again, tickets available at WGNradio.com/events. All right, goodbye, Clay, and I'll say hello to TJ in a few months.
I can't wait for that day at DuPage. We'll talk to you soon, John.
So long. In a few months. Let's see. This is the end of August. You got September, October, and 1st of November. News around the corner, and the Vibe Score segment is still to come your way on WGN. Our Vibe Score segment will come your way in the next half hour. We'll start with the music segment then and talk about news and sports and TV and whatnot. So why are we playing that song there right now, Griffin? We're not vibing that song, are we?
No, but it is the number two selection on Pitchfork, the music website's list of the top songs of the 1970s.
Okay, here it is, yeah.
That came in at number two.
That Pitchfork said the top 10 songs of the 1970s?
Yeah. Well, okay. they did a top 200. I sent you the top 10 out of that.
Okay. This is one of those lists they make just to make people angry.
I don't. You say that about every list we do.
Except the ones I do. But all right, well, tell us what Pitchfork says are the top 10, then, songs of the 70s.
Real quick here, we got Transmission by Joy Division. I know that's a favorite of yours.
I don't know that song, and I lived in the 70s.
How about Dreams by Fleetwood Mac? That comes in at number 9. I know you know that one.
That's fine.
Marquee Moon by Television is number 8. I Want to Be Your Lover by Prince, 7. 6 is David Bowie with Heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Wuthering Heights by Kate Bush is number 5. The name recognition, I will admit, is not exactly
these
that.
These people are such show-offs. Really? Really? Fine. Keep going.
When you hear it, though, you know that. You know that song, and it's great.
Sure.
Number 4 is I Feel Love by Donna Summer, a song that...
Not one song by John Denver in the top 10, but keep going.
Number 3, I think the top 3 is, you can't argue with, What's Going On by Marvin Gaye, number 3. 2, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough by Michael Jackson. Number 1, another David Bowie song, Life on Mars.
Well, I think you could take those last 3, Marvin Gaye, Michael Jackson, David Bowie, and pick one, and you could win that argument, right?
Yeah.
Fleetwood Mac probably should be in the top 10.
I knew this would get you riled, and we don't have enough time to linger here, but
okay.
I enjoyed that.
Then next week, young man, we're going to come back to this, and I'm going to set them right. I will give you my top 10 songs of the 70s. Would you like to hear that list?
I would like to see how much of that overlaps with their top 200. Yeah, we'll do that. That'll be fun.
Or maybe it won't be. All right, we'll pause here for the news. After the news, our Vibe Score segment. That's always fun. And the boys from the beat talk a little sports. How about that Chris Bryant? That's all coming up on WGN. The luckiest thing that has happened. You are the best thing that's happened to me. Who knew? Thank you, Bob Kessler. Thank you, Barbara Streisand. John Williams here on W. Oh, shoot, Griff, I got to play my little music standby in 3, 2, 1. Hit it. Okay, so there is Barbara Streisand singing a duet from her new CD. This is our Vibe Score segment. It's a free app you can get. Tom Hegberg, my cousin, and I developed this, and it's free for your iPhone. Go to Vibe Score at the store and download it. We'll feed you topics that are of interest to you, and at the end of each story, there's a scorable question. So are we scoring the new Barbara Streisand CD here, Griff?
Yeah, I think we just asked, how do you feel about Barbara?
Yeah, I'm a big Babs fan.
In case you haven't heard the album yet, but yeah, what would be your score?
For Barbara Streisand, I think she's like the best ever, so I'd put her at a 94. I don't think I've actually vibed on her yet, if you'll pardon the expression. But I would say 94 feels about right for me.
Okay.
I know some people don't like Barbara Streisand and some people don't like her singing, but I'm on board the singing. How about you, Bob Kessler? Are you a big Barbara Streisand fan?
Not a big fan. I've never gone out of my way to listen to her, but I appreciate her massive talent.
Yeah, well,
these
then,
duet
that's
partners
fair enough.
Are kind of a little unexpected.
Yeah,
Anne Hathaway, Alec Baldwin.
The one that we just heard was her and Alec Baldwin, which I was very surprised to see, but it sounded good.
It sounded good enough. I mean, really, she's done a duets CD before. She's done kind of everything before. She's doing songs she's done before. And it's just fun. I think if you're a Streisand fan like I am, you'll embrace this. I went online to look for the videos, and it's so Barbara Streisand. It's so controlled and controlling. The videos make her look so good because they don't just have music videos per se. You watch maybe 20 seconds of her in the studio singing with whoever the partner is.
Yeah.
And then an interview where they talk and they're well lit. And then they go back to it. And I'm like, oh, shut up. Just give me the music, will you? But they don't.
It is like a campaign commercial for Barbara.
It totally is like that.
And you may have noticed that we only heard about 20 seconds of that song there. I wonder why. Maybe it's because... it was cut to avoid one of those interviews.
or they don't want to give you the whole song, so now you got to go, I don't know, download it or buy it or whatever we're supposed to do. But I felt it was a little Barbara Streisand-y for me. But I like the music, so I'm going to give it a good score, musically anyway.
Yeah, so you're 94. I'm around 80. I think she's just incredibly talented. Why not? 58. Is the
Did
score
you see
it's getting
58?
Right now. Yeah.
Well, let's work
haters.
That one up. Come on, Barbara will be very disappointed if she doesn't do better on Vibe Score. Did you see her on with Jimmy Fallon?
I did not, no.
So she does Barbara Streisand, he does Donald Trump. They sing Anything You Can Do, I Can Do Better. And then they change the words, like, I can build a wall better. Oh, yes, you can. Oh, no, you can't. And he does a very good Trump. It was very funny. Very funny. Okay, so Streisand's getting a 58 on Vibe Score. What's next?
Also in the music category, after a four-year hiatus that had fans in a tizzy, Frank Ocean is back with his sophomore album, Blonde.
Oh, yeah.
The first track is called Nikes. It's also kind of the first single. I don't know if you called it a single exactly, but it's the only one that he has a video for so far. And we put that up and asked what you think.
Yeah, what did you score that one, Griff?
I went around where you were for Barbara Streisand, 94, 93. Well, I love
I'm
it.
I'm a huge, big Frank. Yeah, I am too. Yeah, we're Frank Ocean fans, aren't we? Uh-huh. Is this the same kind of sound? If you like the first CD, you'll like this?
I think it's a little more experimental. It's a little more sprawling and shambling. It goes all over the place a little bit and less controlled. Like the first album, really, those were traditional sounding songs. These ones are a little free floating. But yeah, all the basics are the same in the same spot. It still sounds like Frank Ocean, and it's wonderful.
Frank Ocean's Blonde new CD is getting an 86 on Vibe Score. What's next?
In the viral category, the guy that surprised his parents by skydiving while on a Skype call with them. Did you see that?
I did not.
It's amazing.
Holy cow. So he's Skyping with him and then jumps out of the plane or something?
Yeah. Yeah, and they're like, where are you? And he's screaming at them. And and then he wow. jumps and the mom yells, I thought he was on a bus.
And he lives, right?
He lives, yeah, yeah.
I wonder, were they really ticked? Or did we get a sense of what their reaction was?
You know, you have to just check out the video for yourself. It's hard. They're just so aghast at what's going on. It's okay. Pretty funny. I was thinking, yeah, I like this video. I think it's funny. If someone did that to me,
yeah,
I would be furious. Or I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't be, but it's just hard to know how you would possibly react to something so crazy.
Well, it's not exactly a practical joke, but I don't like practical jokes at all, so my inclination is no, but that sounds like fun to me. I see it's getting a pretty good score. 76 for the viral category is higher than a lot of them get. Although the one that we had prior to that, of the two guys dancing at a wedding, I don't know who got married. I think it was a man and a woman, but these two guys are buddies and they know how to dance. So on a lark, they danced at the wedding. And that is one of the most joyful things we've put up there. And that's also in the viral category. Okay, what's next, Griff?
Yeah, that's a fun one. In the movies category, we got another list for you that you might not care for, but I didn't mean to double them up like that, but it's just how it worked out. At BBC, they've pulled over 150 critics all over the world and compiled their list of the best 100 movies of the 21st century. So since 2000. Boyhood, Eternal Sunshine, Spirited Away, and There Will Be Blood. Those all cracked the top 10.
Huh.
Considered by many to be modern classics. Number one was David Lynch's Mulholland Drive. That took the number one spot. And so we asked, have you seen it? Do you like this choice for the best movie since 2000?
Boy, I'd sure put There Will Be Blood in there. As you know, wasn't a big fan of Boyhood. I'm an outlier on that one.
Yeah, you didn't like it too much.
I didn't get it. I gotta go. I know, and it's, hey, John, there's nothing to get. It's a movie about a guy who grows up in real time. Don't you get it? I gotta go back and get it. But There Will Be Blood. Wow. And then, Griff, what's the story on Mulholland Drive? Refresh my memory on that.
It's the story of Naomi Watts is the main character. She's a small town girl that moves to Los Angeles to be an actress. And then you lose the plot about there. It's a collection of just eerie, dissonant, very creepy scenes. that lead her to different places to meet different people. Some characters are introduced that you have no idea what they have to do with anything.
Yeah.
I think you're supposed to experience it rather than really track what's going on. So it's very frustrating for a lot of people.
One of those movies, huh?
It's definitely one of those. And it was frustrating for me, too, the first time I saw it. But I have to say, it wouldn't be number one on my list, probably, but... Just because I don't, there's too much mystery surrounding it for me. I don't know what the deal is. But the first time I watched it, I was sort of entranced. I think the way you're supposed to be. It scared the whatever out of me. I was so afraid watching it.
Like what's going to happen to her next, or who these people are.
Some really horrifying things do happen. She meets some really terrifying creatures and people. The whole thing is completely bizarre and. Amazing, I think, for sure. So I understand why it's at number one. It wouldn't be mine. I'd probably go with There Will Be Blood, honestly. I love that movie. Or something else.
100 best movies of the 21st century, according to 150 critics, Mulholland Drive, number one.
I'd give that choice on that. Like an 85. Getting an 82 right now. So that's pretty good. Mm.
Well, it's no Lobster now, is it, Griff?
No, but, you know, maybe it's some similar influences. Does anything pop into your mind, like in the last 15 years or the last 10 years?
Well, when you give me that list, your favorite movie you saw? You know, when Quentin Tarantino was first coming out, and I don't know that that qualifies for this list, I don't remember being waylaid by somebody as much as I was, you know, anything that he was doing. Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs.
Those are both 90s, so they would not qualify.
But they don't make the list.
Maybe something like Inglourious Basterds. I think that does show up later on in the list.
I like that movie, but of these... There Will Be Blood has to be my number one.
Yeah, when you get into the 10 through 20, you got like No Country for Old Men and Inside Llewyn Davis. I love both those Coen Brothers movies. Zodiac by David Fincher, about the Zodiac Killer in California. That's actually might be my number one also. It's hard to pick.
Have seven number ones, don't you?
Yeah, don't worry about it. This is my...
Is The Road on there? That's a good one.
No, I don't think The Road made it. But Bob,
I would put that in there. I agree with most of those, although I didn't think... The Zodiac was that good.
Oh, I love that movie.
It was just an okay David Fincher movie, but not a great one.
It's very long. It turns a lot of people off.
Cut to the last one, Griff. Let's do the Chicago category.
Oh, yeah, sure. We mentioned it a couple times already. The Cell, a.k.a. U.S. Cellular Field, is now going to be Guaranteed Rate Field. What's your vibe for this new name for the home of the Sox?
Let's start with the Sox fan here, Mr. Kessler.
My vibe is like 1%. But I was the same way when it went to U.S. Cellular. I was like, forget these guys. And then we got used to it, and then no one thought about it anymore. Although I think it's a weird-sounding sponsor or weird-sounding firm. I don't even remember what it is. It's Guaranteed Rate Field.
Yeah.
Guaranteed Low. And their logo is a downward-pointing arrow. That's the bad part. You don't want that.
Not for your sports team.
No, for other things. Yeah.
For anything. So Bob gives it a 1. Griff, I'm going to vibe that a 9.
Okay.
And we'll be pulling the aggregate number down.
Not much, though. It's already at 13. You can't go much further down than that.
That's got a good sound to it.
Does that sound right to you?
You can get the Vibe Score app. It's free for your iPhone. Vibe Score is one word, VibeScore. Thank you, Griffin. The Boys from the Beat preview their show next on WGN. All right, let's see what the guys are getting ready for their little sports gig. Adam Hoge and Mark Carmen are the Boys from the Beat. Hi, fellas.
Hello, John. Adam is watching the final 5 minutes of the epic Bears game that's going on right now. Bears are actually trying to set a record, and I hope they get it, although it's in very much doubt. They could be shut out for the second time in the preseason, which has never happened before in the history of the franchise, John. And when you're bad, I think it's fun to be really, really, really bad. Don't just, you know.
Embrace your badness.
Yeah, like average bad, that's like kind of, I mean, that's too relatable. But being really bad, I mean, that stands out. So the Bears are on the cusp of being really bad, but apparently they're on the 3-yard line, so I think they're going to score, John. Now they just scored. Okay, so that's that.
Wah, wah. You can't win for losing. Right. You know, well, is this true then, Mark? Would you say that the preseason won't tell you how good you can be, because winning those games might not mean that much, but it can tell you how bad you might be if you can only score once in eight quarters.
Right. You don't feel comfortable unless you have a history of winning to be like, whoa, you're winning preseason games, particularly if you're coming off, you know, a six-win season like the Bears. But when you're this inept, it is, I'd say, large red flags for what's coming this season. You never know, though. What's up?
You don't think you're being a little unfair about this or harsh? Are you just being one of those media sports guys? Is that the vibe? Are all Bears fans going, wow, we are going to suck this year?
Have I been reduced to media sports guy?
Well, how really, what do you think the average Bears fan is saying about this team?
Oh, the average Bears fan is most definitely saying exactly this. This is not the least bit hyperbolic. And I've known to be hyperbolic every now and then, John. I'm not gonna run from that. But they're, you know, this is a team that got rid of Matt Forte, got rid of Martellus Bennett. Their offensive coordinator is now the head coach in Miami, and Adam Gase and Jay Cutler had a big bonding. And you're talking about a team that's the second year of John Fox, second year of Ryan Pace, two first-round draft picks that we really don't know a whole lot about. So they're very much in transition. I mean, this is not – if you put Bears personnel, upper management, head coach John Fox on a lie detector test, what are the expectations for this year? They would not be telling you it's super high. I'm sorry.
How good's the division? Is Green Bay going to be good? Do you like Minnesota this year? Detroit?
Listen. Minnesota has been impressive. Their defense is strong. I like Mike Zimmer, their head coach, and I'm a fan of Teddy Bridgewater to a point. He's got there's obviously another level for Teddy Bridgewater that he's got to get to if Minnesota's really going to be a team that goes deep into the playoffs. But he's young. I mean, I'd rather be running with Teddy Bridgewater than Cutler at this point, even though Jay had a great year last year. And then the Packers are the Packers as long as Aaron Rodgers is there. You could make an argument, a pretty strong one, John, when you look at the stats, that Aaron Rodgers is the best quarterback of all time. You can make that argument. Not a lot of people would go crazy on that. But regardless, you know, Green Bay's better than the Bears. The Vikings are better than the Bears. The Bears are battling it out with the Lions right now for the bottom of the division. So, I guess Hamp was at the game today. He was in the press box, and that's the beauty of WGN on a Bears Sunday, win or lose, always entertaining. Hamp will be in Cosby. We'll talk to Hamp today at 4:10. So, and Hamp, you know, look, it's not fun to be negative on whatever the date is today, August the...
Yeah, no kidding.
Right, so that's okay. So let me flip it around. I'm super excited about the potential for the Bears to improve, because they have nowhere to go but up.
Well, now there's the glasses half full. Mark, how painful was that?
Well, right, and more importantly, listen, the Cubs are down. Chris Bryant hit another home run today.
Did he really?
Yeah, and they're down last night, two runs in the eighth, and he hits a bomb, and then Jason Hayward, of all people, gets a double, and they score in the ninth, and then another home run in the tenth from the MVP to be. I mean, this is ridiculous.
Well, I was going to ask you this question. I will now. So if you said a game or just a moment, maybe even a single play for the Cubs this year that has just been really fun, off the charts, what quickly comes to mind? Games, moments, single plays. Oh. Like, you've got to say Rizzo standing on the wall and plucking that last one out of the stands. I mean, was fun.
You got a no-hitter from Arrieta early in the year.
We were down 6-0 in a game that every other team in baseball would have lost, and we won.
Right, and then you had the wild pitch to win it at home on a Friday afternoon against who was that? I forget. It all blends together. To me, like, it's not just one moment. It's just been a season of, I mean, they started out 25-6,
yeah,
and it's just so un-Cub-like. Like, it's just been, you just know you're good and can enjoy it. It's borderline unheard of.
Well, so here's my concern, because towards the All-Star break, I was getting all negative. I was getting really worried and stuff like that. And then we came out strong the second half, and we had a great August, didn't we? I mean, it was unbelievable. Am I right about that, Mark?
Yeah, you are, John. They've been phenomenal since the break.
So here's my worry.
Okay.
I hope that we don't repeat in the second half what we did in the first half.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. Like,
No, because you're going to be in the playoffs, but it's what matters is who's hot at the end of the season.
Right, 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 right.
I'd hate to see us have another Mets situation.
Right, right, right. Well, listen, peaking too soon, that's the concern right now. They're 19-4 in August.
Wow.
I'm not a math major, but I'm pretty certain that's pretty good.
That's good.
Yeah, so, listen, they have to make sure they're healthy, so don't push guys, but they have a huge luxury right now where they just don't have to.
Yeah,
they're going to have right? I mean, they're going to have the division clinched by mid-September, you would think, and they'll be able to line up their rotation, and they won't play, and the schedule came out this week, they don't play until October the 7th, so there's going to be that's going to be the talk. Is it too long of a layoff? They won't have played since Sunday. How much do you play the guys when you've got a whole 5 days of rest?
Yeah, I don't like that.
You're paranoid Cub guy, John.
How many games are they going to win, Mark?
Well, they're on pace for 105, so
maybe they slack off a little. 101.
I don't know if they're going to slack off, because teams come September, you've got, you know, everybody's playing minor leaguers and the season's over and they got a ton of games left with the Brewers and whatnot. So I think 100 plus. It's going to be. I mean, what they've got 82 already. I mean, it's just
it's pretty fun to watch. That's for sure.
And they're young, right?
Oh, I know. Well, that's the thing. How old is Chris Bryant? 24.
He's 16.
16 in dog years. I mean, it's amazing. Okay, Carm, we're done. Have a great show. As always, say hello to Adam and say nice things about the Bears for me. Okay.
Oh, you got it, John. Thank you.
It's Mark Carman and the boys from The Beat. After the news is next. This is WGN.